So welcome, everyone. Thank you for coming tonight to our new practice space here at Yogani. Actually, this is the first time I've ever been here, so interesting to be here. I think the last time I was with the Tampa Sangha was on New Year's, so it's been over a month. So I wonder what you've all been up to. What kind of teachings and practices have you been perpetrating on each other while I was gone? What? Anything of interest? Any interesting issues raised? Or
last week we did touching the earth. Mm-hmm. We did six earth touching to transmit, receive good energy from our new space of practice.
Oh, good. How'd it go? Good. So you did touching the earth. That's a wonderful practice. You know, one of the nice things about Thich Nhat Hanh and the Plum Village community over the last 20 or so years, they've done a lot of experimentation, especially since they live together in community. In Plum Village and the other centers around Europe and in this country, they've found interesting ways to practice together. The earth touchings are the three and the five, and I guess now the six, are wonderful practices for feeling the connection. The connection, kind of the vertical connection, going back historically with one's personal ancestors, families, country, society, feeling that sense of continuity. We're not just those of us who live very much in the world of self feel very alone and feel very kind of solid in their aloneness. But when you do practices like the earth touchings, we are forced to acknowledge so much interconnection, that we are the recipients. Our body, so much of our way of looking at things, our thoughts, our values, and our sufferings, our happinesses, have come to us from the past and from many others that we have encountered in this life. And so even though we claim ownership of our bodies and we claim ownership of our thoughts and our feelings, our issues, my this, my that, in truth, they have developed in a matrix of interrelationship. And so that is why we can say that each of us have the capacity of healing and transforming the wounds of one's ancestors, the sufferings of our parents, right? Because much of that sufferings or just ways of living that were not productive of happiness and well-being, of love, of kindness, of understanding, right? That they transmitted consciously or unconsciously to us, they also received from their parents, grandparents. You know, we don't know where it all began. But we know that for one reason, it was transmitted to us, and many of us, when we lived unconsciously, just lived it out. We thought it was us. We thought it was me. But when we begin to look more deeply and we see this vast web of interrelationship that is manifesting within us as thoughts, feelings, behaviors, tendency, urges, feelings, we realize there is so much of others that are present in us, which means, again, those things within us which we like, those things within us that we feel we have benefited from, we cannot take credit for, because they were often given to us by others, nurtured by others, supported by others, inspired by others. In the same way, those kinds of difficulties or issues or sufferings that have been transmitted to us, the wonderful thing about those is once we understand what they are, we realize we don't have to, again, to continue to act out and live out from them. Right? We can stop. We can understand. We can look deeply. And we can heal and transform. So in that real way, we are healing and transforming our ancestors, our parents. They often did not have that capacity, right? Because of the reality of their lives, difficulties of their lives, or just because they didn't have any insight or understanding into what was consciously pushing them in this life, or else they just didn't have the tools to heal and transform. So we are very fortunate. In a certain way, I like to think of it when we look at that all the issues that we have received from our ancestors, from our past, from others in this life. We can really say, if we want, the buck stops with me. I do not have to continue to transmit that. I can only, you know, if I'm conscious, I can do my best to transmit that which is healthy, that which is beneficial, that I've received from others. And that which I've received from others which is harmful or not supportive of goodness in life, I don't have to transmit anymore, right? If I am conscious and aware, and really do my best to embrace these parts of myself in conscious awareness, in mindfulness, and apply the practices of healing and transformation, self-healing and transformation, to them. So the three and the five earth touchings help us get in touch with that in a very a direct way. So good. What else have you been up to?
And you're going to make a wonderful discussion on resistance.
Resistance.
Letting go of resistance.
Hmm. Are you an expert in resistance? Thank you for sharing your expertise with the Sangha. So you... The pith of your presentation was what?
That some of us, certainly me for one, experience resistance to just what's happening in this moment, in this life, kind of dragging your feet for various reasons. It's a good practice to just let go.
Good, right? Yeah, so resistance is separation, right? When we resist life, really we're talking about resisting life, which means whatever's happening, you know, that's life. Like, this is life, right? For example, this is life. For example, this is life. In other words, this is life. I mean, we don't have a life outside of this. Everything else is imagined, right? We may imagine we have a home, but we're not there now, are we? It's just imagined. It's just something we think about. And things do burn down, so I don't want to be gloomy or anything, but, you know, this is... You know, life only occurs in the present. Right? Over and over we hear that, but it's hard for us to recognize it. Everything else is something we are thinking about. The past does not exist. We can only think about the past, remember the past, imagine the past. The future doesn't exist. All we can do is imagine, fantasize, worry. I mean, all these things are all taking place in thought. They're not taking place in reality. The only reality that exists is this moment. Right? And so, as Andrew wisely, you know, pointed out, what is my relationship to what is happening in the moment? Am I separate from? Do I see it as something different than me? Or am I open? No resistance, no separation, no walls, no projections. And this is not because you're taking any profound philosophical stance. You could be seeing it that way. But it's because this is this is our life unfolding. Whether it's wanted or unwanted, desired or undesired, we judge it good or bad, right? Which we do, and that's part of our resistance, the way we manipulate and manufacture. The truth is, this is all we have, this is what is arising. And our job is simply to be open and to what? And deal with it. And hopefully we are learning through our practice to deal with it in a way that is has some degree of wisdom, intelligence, openness, compassion, you know. That's how we are to relate to this moment. Because this, again, if we want to if we have a certain way that we want to live our life, right? Like we might say, I want to lead a good life, right? We talk this way, don't we? I want to lead a good life. I want to be a good person. I want to be a kind person. I want to be, right? All these things we say about how we want to live life. Well, where are we going to do it? Except in life. And where is our life unfolding that we're going to undertake this living this way? In life as it unfolds, not in some imagined universe. I was over in New Smyrna Beach this past few days. There's a sangha over there. And I usually go over there once a year to meet with them, do a day of mindfulness. And somebody was talking about their practice. And it was late in the day, you know, long day. It was kind of late in the day. And I found myself saying to them, I had to let them in on one of my pet peeves, which is when people talk about their practice. How their practice is going or not going. We might find some of us that we talk that way. My practice is not good these days. My practice is good these days. My practice is solid. My practice is a mess. People talk this way about their practice. As if the purpose of all this is to cultivate something called a practice, in which we then judge how it's doing. Right? We give ourselves, you know, it's like we manufacture the thing we call our practice, whatever that is, and then we rate it. Right? I'll give myself a B minus this week on my practice. But I'd like to get an A next semester. You know, we kind of that's kind of our mind. We kind of evaluate and weigh and. You know, this is not about becoming a good meditator. This is not about becoming a good practitioner. Right? This is about the life that we live. That's our practice. Our practice is our life. That's what we are transforming. So all the practices we do, the meditative practices, the practices of mindfulness, the practices of meditation, the practices of concentration, the practices of insight, the practices of compassion, the practices of loving kindness, the practices of patience, the practices of acceptance, the practices of deep looking, right? The practices of generosity, the practices of vigilant introspection. Right? You know all those practices that in this path we say we do. They're all in the service of what? Transforming the quality of our life. And where do we live our life? In this moment. So if I'm practicing, if I'm somebody who says I practice mindfulness, concentration, then I am practicing it right now. Right? Where else am I going to practice it? If I am practicing not being resistance, but being open, and where am I practicing it? Right now. Not in some altered state, some imagined state, or in some geographical state, like, you know, on my cushion. That's where I practice. Does anybody here spend all their 24 hours of the day on their cushion? No. We spend a very small part of our day on our cushion. We spend most of our day doing, being, interacting. So we need to practice that. For example, we practice metta. We practice loving-kindness meditation, right? People know about that. Practice it here. So I just want to let you know that the practice of loving-kindness involves people. It's not just some way we think. It's not just an affirmation. It's not just a prayer. It's the way we are with each other. It is the actual practice of kindness with people. Right? It's a practice of being friendly with people. It's a practice of non-discrimination and offering friendliness and kindness and support to real people, all the people we encounter in the day. That's the practice of metta. That's the practice of loving kindness. So it's important, again, you know, why do we practice the piano? So we can play good music. That's what it's all about. Why do we do these various practices? So we could be good human beings. Wise, intelligent, helpful, supportive, egoless, selfless. So we need to remember that, because oftentimes, especially lay people who are busy with work, with family responsibilities, we often see the activities of our life, the responsibilities of our life, as what? Obstacles to our practice. Right? We say, I really, you know, it's been very difficult to practice lately. I've just, you know, been involved too much in life, too much going on to practice. You might have heard people talk this way. But when I hear that, it's like somebody saying, practice is some kind of this laboratory, experimental process that goes on, you know, in a very defined manner, right? That's what practice is. And then life is this other thing. But life is where we live, right? So we should never say, you know, my job, my family responsibilities, you know, my caretaking of this or doing that are getting in the way of my practice, right? Because wherever we are, we can practice mindfulness. Wherever we are, we can practice being in the present moment. Wherever we are, we can practice kindness. Wherever we are, we can practice letting go of resistance, I mean, is there any place that you know of where you can't practice these things? No, I mean, it's a serious question. Because many people are always talking about how their life is preventing them from really practicing. You know, again, our practices are life, and all the things that unfold in our life are where we practice. You know, if we can only practice mindfulness in these ideal conditions, if we can only practice concentration in these ideal conditions, if we can only practice loving kindness on a meditative way, but you know, when we get around human beings, we really can't stand them, you know? It's not really much of a practice, is it? We want our practice to be robust. We want our practice to be alive, which means it'll be a little messy. Practice in here can be often unmessy, very clean, very neat. Bells, we stand. Bells, we walk. Bells, we sit. People give us meditative instructions. I mean, it's quite neat. But life is messy. Our hands get dirty in life. But that's where we need to practice. Why? Because that's where the mess is. And as people who not only want to benefit ourselves, but also want to benefit others, we have to learn to practice with others. In less than ideal conditions. But as it's said in the Bodhisattva Way, you know, in this text that I've been teaching in and out of for months now, The Way of the Bodhisattva by Shantideva, and you know, we have this intensive going on, about 50 people are involved in the practice and study of this way. The author, Shantideva, he says something very interesting. He says, to people reading the text, he said, in this way, in this practice, in this tradition, we need to, he's talking about, let's say, who you respect, who you give praise to, kind of who you put on the altar, you know. And he says, 50% of the images on the altar, the people you should respect and give praise to, are the Buddhas, are the teachers. You know, these are the ones who teach us and instruct us and show us how to practice and inspire us. You know, these are the... but they only get 50% of the space. He said, the other 50% of the space, you know, are all the people give you a hard time. Very interesting. He said, you've got to put them up on the altar. Because he said, they also are inspiring us to practice. People who are difficult to love inspire us to what? To love. We have to overcome our resistance. Right? They help us open. People we say, I can't understand them. Right? They help us develop greater capacity to understand. People we don't like help us look deeply into why we like and dislike. People who make us angry, right, help us pay attention to the seeds of anger that are within us, unhealed, waiting to pop out. Right? If we didn't have people stepping on our toes, saying no to us, treating us in ways that we don't want or don't think we should be treated, how would we ever know that the seeds of anger are inside us? Does that make sense? You know, how would we know that the seeds of intolerance are inside us? How would we know that the seeds of fear are inside us? How would we know that the seeds of despair are inside us, right? The seeds of impatience, the seeds of frustration. How would we know it unless circumstances or individuals push that? So that is why Shantideva says very wisely, give respect and credit to the teachers and the ones that are inspiring, but give equal attention and respect to the difficult aspect of life, because that they really force us, help us. They force us. They don't force us because we could easily just give into our habit energy and be angry and pissed and not understanding and unloving, right? I mean, so, but if we're practicing, they force us. If we're open, no resistance to see ourselves, right? And hopefully, if we are people who want to transform, right? We want to see that we have these seeds inside us. And, you know, the more difficult the situation is, the more difficult the person is, the more clearly we see that these seeds are in me, not in them. So that's why it's often said in the teachings that in a certain way, you know, people often say, I'd love to be a monk or nun, then I could really practice deeply. I'd love to be a hermit, and then I could really, you know, live away from all this nonsense. Then I could really practice deeply. But many people think the deepest practice are those people who practice in the world, because you're always rubbing up against things. Right? It's hard to get comfortable in this world. Because so clearly, as we bump up against each other, we see our own attachments. We see our own self-centeredness. We see our own resistance. We see our own judgments. We see our own need to control and manipulate. And right, so we wouldn't see that, right? If we were off in a beautiful little place up in the mountains, right? We could think what? I'm pretty developed. Right? I've been up here 5 years now, and I never get angry. I mean, I'm not scared of anything. Nothing's really bothering me. Right? I get along with everybody. You know, right? One could believe that. So that's why it's said in Zen, a small sage hides him or herself in the mountains. A great sage hides him or herself in the marketplace. So that's an old, one of those old Zen sayings, but it's saying the same thing. You live alone, you live in ideal conditions, you have the capacity of being just a little sage. Again, because your sagacity, your calmness, your peace of mind, is all based on really circumstance. Right? But if you're in the marketplace, which means the hustle and bustle, the give and take, the push and pull of life, right? If you can have a peaceful mind, a calm mind, an insightful mind, an open mind, in the marketplace, then you're a great sage. You're a good practitioner. That's why, actually, traditionally in Zen, going back to China and probably into Korea and Japan, traditionally, students, after they had been studying under their teacher for a while and had a certain degree of realization, kind of finished their training, they would be sent off to wander about, you know, to meet other teachers, to go on pilgrimage, you know, to kind of get, you know, to get, you know, get things a little messy as a way of kind of testing, you know, their realization. Because it's very easy to, alone again in ideal circumstances, to think you're pretty hot stuff, right? What's that? It's either it's related to the Buddha or some... You know, some story, somebody comes to this teacher again. He's very well known for his peace of mind and his, you know, all that. And this guy just starts cursing at him. You're the biggest phony, the biggest jerk, you're, you know. And the guy's just getting, all of a sudden this great teacher's getting angrier and angrier, you know what I mean? You're just a worthless, you know, and he just gives him the hardest time. And all of a sudden this person who's always been esteemed, always very bows to them, everybody treats him right. All of a sudden somebody comes along and just kind of starts giving him a hard time. All of a sudden what? Those seeds we all have, the seeds of anger, the seeds of self-righteousness, the seeds of self, right? When they start getting watered, all of a sudden they come up. So it's very easy to fool oneself and think one is more developed or more calm or peaceful or more advanced than one is if one doesn't have that capacity to have these kind of encounters in life. So for all of you who think you're in difficult life or situations, from a certain point of view you may be, but from another point of view, it's a great opportunity. Because if you can really embrace the situation you're in and really turn it around, and rather than having that difficult situation of watering negative seeds within yourself and having them just grow stronger, right? You can use a situation to water the positive seeds, the seeds of understanding, the seeds of deep looking, the seeds of mindfulness, seeds of patience, seeds of generosity. And so those seeds will now begin to grow within you. And those habitual seeds, those habitual negative seeds, those seeds that cause the arousal of emotional affliction in oneself, will diminish. So what else? So Andrew talked about resistance. Mindfulness training.
We did the mindfulness trainings a couple of weeks ago on the third training, True Love, and talked about how that encompasses a whole lot of stuff that people do, relationships and family and status and all that, and how it sort of all comes back down to being loving and compassionate and joyful and unbiased.
All that good stuff. Yeah.
All that good stuff.
Yeah. Good. So, before we do a little formal Dharma talk, does anyone have any questions? Any questions about the practice? Anybody new or anybody old? Any questions about the practices we did tonight? Any questions about anything that was said so far? Just any questions that you may have in terms of as you look in your life or the situations in life that you're dealing with. That you may not be clear how to deal with them or how to transform them, how to overcome resistance. Again, easily to talk about these things, but it's important that we know how to practice them in reality. So please don't be shy or self-conscious. But if you have any questions about anything that we're dealing with here, which is a lot, please feel free to ask a question. Yes.
Yeah, from when I first started reading, I read Thich Nhat Hanh, I read Living Buddha, Living Christ, and Grant Christian. It was a great bridge to from my root religion to Buddhism. And brought a lot of what I didn't think I liked and my root religion out that I did like, actually, understand.
Mm-hmm.
And, is that still the... same stance, I guess, with Buddhism, isn't it? That all the religions should be honored, and all religions, all legitimate religions, or spiritual paths, I should say. Religions, kind of a Spanish word, but spiritual, all legitimate spiritual paths, or should be honored, whether they're Buddhist or not.
I'm trying to frame it. I mean, it's certainly true what you said. I think the interesting thing about going back to the Buddha And again, remember the Buddha, began to teach in the context of a quite, of a Vedic tradition, which is now called Hinduism. So it was a very established religion or practice that everyone believed in. And there were lots of teachings, lots of gods, and people would kind of ask him about these things, and he just never got into it in a certain way. I mean, to him, in his teachings, it was really about, the way you live, the way you meditated. It was a path of transformation, and he didn't call it anything, and nor did he make it an issue. So my experience, in Asia, you find it a mix. That obviously Buddhism spread as an ism or a teaching spread throughout Asia, but people who had their own animistic or shamanistic or Taoist or Confucianist kind of backgrounds also brought that along. I mean, they were never told to give up anything. They were told to embrace something. So I'm just saying, I don't think there's like a specific teaching saying that, but I think that's certainly perfumes tradition in a lot of Buddhism, which is this real tolerance and acceptance and not getting into attacking or putting down other religions or teachings, unless there's something that's really teaching things or putting forth practices that are harmful. So I'm saying I think that's the background that allows people, Asian teachers who come here like Thich Nhat Hanh or the Dalai Lama, to say to people, it's really up to you. If you want to embrace Buddhism or if you want to stay connected to your roots, do you want to stay a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim and practice Buddhism, you can. Do you want to do both, you can. Do you want to, can you be a Buddhist and still go to church on Sunday, you can. I mean, it's... I think here in the West, we are more segmented, more delineated in how we divide things up. And I think that is not the model that I saw in Asia. There's much more openness and tolerance. And I think that's why when you have people like the Dalai Lama, Thich Nhat Hanh, the teachers come here, they go, no, you don't. it's not about that. I mean, if there are still things from your own religious tradition that nourish you or that you feel connected to, stay connected. In that sense, you could say that your Buddhist practice is value-added, to what you already do. So I think it's really both and. I mean, I think there are people who are still very involved in their kind of root religions or religious traditions, where they find various teachings or practice of Buddhism are kind of value-added, or they kind of fill in pieces or expand things. But I think also, we're at a time where, there are many people who are searching outside of their traditions that they were born into because they, for some reason, did not find them compatible or meaningful in ways. So I think it's a time like that there's a lot of mix. I mean, does that answer your question? I mean,
it does. It's just so many of the, there's that little bit of that stream, I guess, that I was brought up with. That you're not with us, you're against us, kind of the craven images. Oh my God, that was my initial thing years and years ago. I just didn't know,
Yeah.
And, it's gone on to what Thich Nhat Hanh did for me was. Going on to be, what he said, what he understood then has been completely confirmed, if you will, because it's just made more Christianity more beautiful for me, and then I really can see what was really going on there, I think, at least some of the more negative things.
Well, I think also, I know for Thay, for Thich Nhat Hanh, I mean, he didn't, he saw how especially younger people, I guess, maybe we were younger people, now we're older people, when we first encountered him. But he just saw that so many younger people were so alienated from their families and from their traditions, and also, and he, and, you know, and I think coming from a culture, a Confucianist culture, a very tradition-based, family-based, you know, place-based culture, seeing kind of people so unattached, kind of sort of rootless, I think he saw as a significant issue. So I think he encouraged people who came to him and were interested in Buddhism and mindfulness and Dharma practice, you know, please also stay connected with your roots. Don't have your Buddhist practice or anything become something that separates you from your family of origins, from your extended families. And I think he was seeing that was happening. And as somebody who very much sees individuals within the context of their families and extended families and communities, he wanted to make sure that people's embrace or interest in Buddhism and Dharma and meditation was not something that widened the gap of separation. Does that? And that's important. You know, we don't. Yeah, we want to maintain these connections and deepen them. And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. Again, I used to attend talks that Thay would give in France, you know, which was, you know, many Europeans, French, Italians, you know, most of them, all of them, Catholics or strong Catholics. And he would just give these talks on, you know, the meaning of, you know, the meaning of the Eucharist. You know, and all of a sudden, you saw all these Catholics going, wow, I never understood, the host and the wine and the blood in this deep way. And, the Trinity in this way. It was kind of fascinating to see him of kind of deepening people's experience and understanding of the symbols and rituals of their own tradition. But again, that's because people like him and the Dalai Lama, you know, they're not attached, you know, they're not... they're not propagandizers of Buddhism, right? They're not evangelicals of Buddhism, right? They want us to grow up, and they want us to be happy, and they want us to transform, to use our experiences, within the experiences that we're getting from these wonderful teachings and practices to meaningfully engage with our society and our families to heal and transform. And you can't do it if you don't have any connection with. So I think that's why, they encourage us to stay connected. And that means something different to everybody. Any other questions? Don't be shy. Good. Looks like during the 4 weeks I was gone, those presentations really made a difference. I want to continue looking into Shantideva. He has a chapter called Patience. Interesting in this chapter, because I think in our American way of looking at things, we see patience as the opposite of impatience, right? And Shantideva sees patience as the antidote of the opposite of anger. So he's got a very interesting take on anger and patience. So he begins this really quite profound chapter saying, all the good works gathered in 1,000 ages, such as deeds of generosity, offerings to the Buddhas, etc., a single flash of anger shatters them. No evil is there similar to anger, no austerity to be compared with patience. Steep yourself, therefore, in patience in various ways, insistently. Those tormented by the pain of anger never know the tranquility of mind. Strange as they will be to pleasure, they will have difficulty sleeping or feeling secure. And so this is interesting, right? In the beginning of this chapter on patience, he right away pulls out anger as a very specifically pernicious emotion. Why? Because when one is angry and the thoughts that are connected to anger, sort of like, and I'm sure everybody here to one degree knows about anger. Is there anybody here who does not know anger? Everybody knows anger. Good. So we know when we're angry, especially when we're very angry. Calmness of mind, equilibrium of mind, good thoughts, loving kindness, generosity, compassion, selflessness, gone. Right? Immediately has left the mind, right? Wiped out. Right? And if we're not careful with whoever we are angry with, dealing with, if we're not careful and we give vent to anger, very easily, days, weeks, months, years of goodness can be wiped out in a flash of anger. So he's kind of setting the stage to let us know that anger is something we need to recognize as being an emotion that has a particular intensity about it that leads to much suffering. And so he says, And then he goes on, of course, to say, like he says here, those tormented by the pain of anger never know tranquility of mind, right? So I think that's obvious, right? For those of us who have spent time in angry mind states, it is very difficult. It is only for the most profound meditated masters, right, to be able to maintain calmness and equanimity of mind when one is enraged. Anybody ever try to put the two of them together? You'd have to be quite a profound practicer, right? Try to stay calm, open, and loving when you're furious at somebody. So he quite obviously says it doesn't happen. And it really causes a great disturbance. And then in here, in verse 7, he says, this is very important. He says, getting what I do not want and all that hinders my desire, in discontent, my anger finds its fuel. From this it grows and beats me down. Okay? So here he's kind of defining what is the cause of anger. Right? Most of us see the cause of anger as situational or people, or, you know, it's all very personal. But here he clearly defines the cause of anger for each of us. Getting what I do not want and all that hinders my desire. Right? So when things happen, situations happen in our life, in the world, at work, in our relationships, right? The way situations unfold, the way people talk, you know what I mean? When things occur that I do not want to occur, anger arises. Is that clear? Anything that hinders my desire, I want, I need, I must have. Right? When that is frustrated in any way, anger arises. So he's defining anger quite broadly, but he's very clear that generally, you know, if you, he's doing it because if you want to to free yourself from anger of all types. And here we're talking from irritation, frustration, through anger, through rage, right? The whole gamut, right? Getting what I do not want and not getting what I want. Is that not clear? Not getting what I want, getting what I don't want. When either of those occur, I become angry. Whether it's very personal, whether it's situational, whether it's one-on-one, or one in a million. That is the cause of this disturbance of my mind. Does anybody disagree with that? It's important when we hear these kinds of phrases that we understand them, because obviously implied is freedom from anger. Right? It's right here, because you just turn it around and you go, what? If I no longer think that what I want, I should get. And if I no longer think that what I don't want, I shouldn't get. Remember, Andrew? What's your key word?
Resistance.
Here it is again. Right? I'm getting what I don't want. Something's happening. Somebody's saying something. Somebody's not doing something I want, you know. And I'm resisting. That means what? I'm saying no rather than yes. I'm saying this is happening, but it shouldn't be happening. That's resistance. And in that resistance to the moment, to the unfolding, either that things aren't working out the way I want, or I'm not getting what I want, right? Things are happening in a way that I didn't think they should happen or unfolding the way, right? That is the source of my anger. Anger arises in reaction to that. This is, he says, the fuel. This is what fuels our anger. And the more we feel it, you know, when you study anger on a psychological level, you understand that one of the characteristics of anger is what? Is obsessive, repetitive thinking. I know when I used to do anger management, that's very clear. That when you get angry, you don't just say it to yourself once. You repeat it over and over. And each time you may even ramp it up a little bit. Right? You remember what made you angry. And you just replay it and replay it and replay it. And you give it little spins. And every time you replay it, I can't believe they said that or they shouldn't have. Right, and you become more and more self-righteous and right, and they become more and more wrong and right. So that obsessive, repetitive quality continues to fuel that which we call anger. It grows and beats us down. It's interesting. Here he says, anger is a foe that has no other purpose but to hurt and injure me. Interesting, right? We don't see anger as an emotion, as a foe. A foe is what? A foe is an enemy. An enemy is what? Someone who wants us not to be happy, not to succeed. An enemy, a foe, is somebody who wants to harm us. We often see other people as foes, but we often don't see within ourselves that there are aspects of ourself, emotions within ourself, that in a certain way are foes, are enemies, because when they enter into our mind, they only do what? Harm. They disturb us. They disturb our peace of mind. They disturb our equanimity. And they cause us to act, to think, to feel, to talk, to speak in ways that cause conflict, pain, suffering to ourselves and others, right? I mean, and so I think in moments of clarity, in moments of purposeful intention, we see that, don't we? We can see that objectively, how anger in a certain way is our foe, often. And yet, when it arises in us, we embrace it like it's our dearest friend. We welcome anger right in. It feels so good, doesn't it? We feel so right. We feel so self-righteous, don't we? We feel often powerful in our anger, our righteous indignation about others. You know, it's only unmindful that we do all the same thing ourselves, but in the moment we don't remember that. So then he says, "So come what may, I'll not upset my cheerful happiness of mine. Dejection never brings me what I want. My virtue will be warped and marred by it." So here's a man who's committed to having a happy mind. Interesting. How many of us have that kind of commitment? It's an interesting commitment. I want to have a peaceful mind. I want to have a happy mind. I want to have a mind that's at ease. How many of us have that kind of commitment? So when something comes along that disturbs that, we don't follow that road. Because we have this commitment. You know, not a la-di-da commitment, you know what I'm saying? Not paper-over commitment, but a real commitment that, to have a certain kind of mind, to cultivate a certain mind. And when thoughts and feelings or paths come up, that destroy that, we go, I'm not going to go there. What purpose? Then he says something which sounds so practical. It's almost like he could have been a self-help guru. Sounds so practical. He says, this is number 10, and then we'll stop here. He says, if there's a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? And if there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? How practical and rational. Right? So he says, you know, difficult situation, troublesome situation, right, occurs. We all know those situations occur, right? Very common in life. He says, if there is a solution, if there's something that can be done, right, then why be downcast? Why be frustrated? Why be dejected? Right? There's no reason. He's sort of saying what? There's a solution. There's a way of dealing with it. Just get on with it. You don't need all that emotionality of frustration, and you know. And if there's no help for it, what use is there being glum? Right? I mean, it's like the, this is exactly the same as the, you know, the 12-step prayer, right? How does it go? Change the things that can be changed, accept the things that can't be changed, the wisdom to know the difference. I mean, this is really that, right? That's what he's saying, right? If something could be done about a situation, then just do it. If nothing could be done about the situation, then accept it. I always find myself saying, could it be this easy? Could it? What do you think? Could it be this easy?
Maybe it's that wisdom to tell the difference that's the hard part.
Well, but again, but just to know that those are the two choices, I think, is the beginning place, right? I mean, only over time with experience do we really learn, but just to know, as life unfolds, you know, whatever situation we're dealing with, either we deal with it, because there is some capacity for some kind of change to occur, or if we believe, you know, then just accept it. Not accept it because you're defeated, not accept it, but accept it because you understand that this is just the way it is. Right? So why be dejected? Why be angry? Why despair? This is the way it is. If there's a remedy when trouble strikes, what reason is there for dejection? And if there is no help for it, what use is there in being glum? Is another interesting thing, and then we'll stop. He really bases patience as the antidote to anger on understanding. Right? He basically says, "Stop personalizing everything." I'm putting this in mind. Stop personalizing everything. Understands that you know, the people are just doing what they're doing because causes and conditions are causing them to act this way. Stop personalizing and blaming. That's your anger is misplaced. And he says here, he says, "I am not angry with my bile and other humors, fertile source of suffering and pain. So why should living beings give offense? They likewise are impelled by circumstance." Right? So he's saying, you know, my stomach hurts. My stomach hurts. It's causing me suffering. Right? Do I get furious at my stomach? Does anybody, when they're suffering from stomach pain, do they get angry at their stomach? I don't know. Does anybody get angry at their stomach? No. Because why? Because our stomachs are not to blame. Right? We know that something happened that caused our stomachs to feel the way they feel and act the way they're acting, right? We understand that. "Although they are unlooked for or undesired, these ills afflict us the same. And likewise, though unwanted and unfought, defilements insistently arise. Never thinking, now I will be angry. People are impulsively caught up in anger. Irritation likewise comes, though never plans to be experienced." And then this famous line, "All defilements of whatever kind, the whole variety of evil deeds, are brought about by circumstances. None is independent, none autonomous. Conditions once assembled have no thought that they will now give rise to some result, nor does that which is engendered think that it has been produced." I mean, in simplicity, all he's saying here is what?
It's empty.
What? It's empty. People are just doing what they're doing. They're not thinking what they're doing. They're not planning what they're doing. They're just doing it. Right? Why are they doing it? Why are they saying what they're saying? Why are they not saying what they're not saying? Why are they doing what they're... Because of their own causes and condition, their own past, their own issues, their own circumstances, which are controlling them. So just like he says, we don't hate our stomachs when they cause us suffering, we should not hate people, be angry at people when they cause us suffering, because they are being impelled by their own causes and conditions, their own situations. So we should be understanding of that, and therefore not let our minds get disturbed by anger, by resentment, a desire to now hurt them, lash out, cause them suffering. In the same way he says, I wouldn't, you know, if my stomach hurts, I wouldn't beat it, would I? That would be silly. That would not be wise. It's an interesting way of looking at things. To see everything that's unfolding in life is just the product of causes and conditions. Everything has an antecedent. Lots of variables are producing. When somebody acts a certain way, you're seeing their childhood, you're seeing their parents, you're seeing their upbringing, you're seeing so much of their life, right? That's what's manifesting. But we don't see all that. We look very one-dimensionally, and we just see them and we go, I'm angry at you. So, Shantideva has advised us to look deeply into situations so our minds can be at ease, so we can be happy and free of anger. And he says patience is the outcome of that. We're patient with situations and people. Why? Because we understand. Anyhow, this is 8th century India, but I think very applicable for 21st century America and the kind of issues we're dealing with. Things haven't changed that much in 1400, 1500 years. So thank you. We'll stop now.